The top shutdown cornerbacks in recent NFL history include Richard Sherman, Josh Norman, Darrelle Revis, and going further back, Rod Woodson and Deion Sanders. But for a good part of the 1970s and 1980s, that distinction was bestowed upon Mike Haynes, who earned 9 trips to the Pro Bowl, would be named to the NFL's 75th anniversary all-time team, and was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1997. Since his playing career ended, Mike has been a strong advocate of prostate cancer awareness, having been diagnosed and surviving that illness himself. Now, over your 14 seasons in the NFL, Mike, you spent 7 with the New England Patriots, 7 with the Los Angeles Raiders. As we talk right now, both the Raiders and the Patriots are atop the AFC and legitimate contenders to reach the Super Bowl. So I'm wondering, who does Mike Haynes pull for?
I root for both teams. Isn't that crazy?
No, you can do whatever you want.
So, that's what I do. I root for both teams, and when they play each other, which has happened a couple of times, I can't lose. One of my teams is going to win, and I just hope that nobody is injured in those games, and it's a good experience for the team that comes out on top.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've seen the Patriots stand out or be the standout team in the NFL for going back to now almost, over 15 years now. But it's great to see the Raiders reemerge. I mean, they haven't been to the playoffs since that Super Bowl trip back in, I think it was 2002 or 2003. But like I said, it's great to see the Raiders come back, even though the NFL, anyone, it doesn't matter who's good, the NFL thrives. But when the Raiders are good, it seems like that helps the league a lot.
Well, I hear a lot of people say that. Because I'm a Raider fan. Of course, I just want to see them always in contention, just like the Patriots. Mm-hmm. My whole career, I played in the AFC, and so I'm always rooting for AFC to win the Super Bowl. It doesn't matter who's in the Super Bowl. I mean, I even rooted for the Denver Broncos.
So I want to go back to your high school days when you were a track and field star at John Marshall High School in Los Angeles, in addition, of course, to being a great football player. Did you have any ambitions to take your track career further as you went on to Arizona State, or was it always football first?
I guess I always had ambitions to continue to run track. I love track. It was a lot of fun. I liked, competing, against the clock. It was an opportunity that I was able to have at Arizona State. A lot of guys, when they're on scholarship for football, they're not really allowed to play other sports. They want them to focus on one sport. But while I was at Arizona State, they let me run on the track team in the spring, and sometimes it was double duty, practice early afternoon for football, and in the evening run on the track team.
From the Sun Devils, you were chosen in the first round by the New England Patriots as the 5th overall selection in the 1976 draft. You had an exceptional rookie season at cornerback with 8 interceptions, winning the NFL Defensive Rookie of the Year, and you were named to your first of 9 Pro Bowls, but you were also great as a punt returner. In fact, you led the AFC that year with 608 punt return yards. As your career went on, you didn't return punts as much, especially when you joined the Raiders. Was that something you wish you could have done more of?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I love running with the ball, having the ball in my hand and trying to make a play. That was a lot of fun for me. And the way my contract was structured, I basically had to be the best in the league to get anything. And there was a player in Denver named Rick Upchurch. I don't know if you remember him, but mm-hmm. He was also a great return guy. And that was basically his contribution to the Broncos, was just returning kicks. Every once in a while he'd come in and catch a pass or whatever, but that was his main role. And I said to my owner, Billy Sullivan, hey, if you guys will give me just half of what he gets, I'll continue to do it. And he says, that's all right. We got Stanley Morgan. He can do it. And so they drafted another player the next year, Stanley Morgan, and he became the returner, and that put me out. So they felt that they felt like it wasn't as important, and if I really wanted to do it, I should do it for free. So, I mean, literally the amount of money I got for being the best in the league, if I told you what it was, you would laugh. So that's why I didn't do it anymore. And over the years, you know, by the time I became came to the Raiders, of course, they had always had great special teams. And I think Greg Pruitt might have been the returner there at that point, and another guy named Clee Montgomery. And those guys were really good, and that was their contribution. They were, you know, they didn't have a big role on the offensive team or the defensive team. Their real role was in special teams, and that's where they made their contribution. So I was I didn't get a chance to continue to do it. It would have been a lot of fun because it is the one thing that I enjoyed most about playing football was running with the ball, mm-hmm. trying to score.
The 1978 season saw a number of major rule changes to help offenses and open up the passing game. Among them was the no contact beyond 5 yards rule, certainly limiting the control a defensive back has on pass receivers. For you, how difficult was that to adapt to?
It wasn't as difficult as I thought it was going to be. There was just it sounded difficult, and there so when the referees or the officials would come around to the different teams and talk about the rule changes, they allowed us to ask questions and try to figure out, you know, how we would go forward with these rule changes. But I got a chance to see that there really was a gray area there, and that the officials, one official might call it one way, or another would call it a different way. And I took advantage of that. And so I knew, and one of the things I asked is, well, what happens if you make contact with the guy at 4 yards? And you're still making contact, even though you're trying to push away from him or he's trying to push away from you. You're still in contact after 8 yards. And they said, well, we won't call on it. That's not what we're trying to stop. And so, oh, okay. So that allowed me to have a lot more freedom and a lot more confidence that I didn't have to remove my hands whenever the guy was about to go by me or whatever. You know, and it gave me a sense of confidence that I was able to use throughout my career. And they still call it the same way. Mm-hmm. I don't think the players, the defensive backs, all across the league play it the same way. But it is a rule change that I thought was probably good for offense and good for the fans and horrible. You know, initially, I thought it was horrible for the defensive backs, but as it turned out, it really wasn't as bad as I thought. They just wanted to make sure that those guys were able to get up the field on their pass routes, and they were, we could still have our hands on them as long as we weren't impeding their route upfield.
Mm-hmm. Offense has certainly been prevalent in the NFL these days, and the violence in football is well documented. Over the last few years, or has been well documented over the last few years, but the hit on your teammate, also talking about 1978, the hit on your teammate Darrell Stingley by Jack Tatum during a preseason game that year, which left him paralyzed for the rest of his life. I read somewhere that had a major effect on you when it happened.
Yeah, well, I almost I really considered getting out of the game. Because that was a hit that I would have made. You know, it wasn't, you know, you really couldn't call it a cheap shot, but maybe you could call it a cheap shot. It was, what we used to say is, even though the receiver can't catch the ball, we hit him anyway because we want him to feel like if they had caught it, they would have really paid the price. And the next time the ball is thrown, they'll short arm it or think twice about catching it. So it was a play that I would have made on a receiver. And at the time, I had started going to team Bible study group meetings and starting to feel differently about, you know, myself and my teammates and my friends and even my job. When that happened, it was really you know, earth-shattering, really. I mean, I thought, geez, that could have been me. What am I doing? You know, what am I doing? And what was Jack doing? When guys heard that I was thinking about getting out of the game, a few of them called me and said, hey, Mike, look, you know, just keep it clean. You know, part of football is getting hit hard and hitting other players hard. That's just part of the game. You know, just help us up. You know, just, you know, you can still do it. You can be a gentleman about it. You don't have to, you know, pump, you know, beat your chest and, you know, point at the guy or whatever. And so that helped me. That helped me rethink it, and I continued to play, hard and hit hard. And of course, I never was involved in any type of situation like that that you're talking about with Daryl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you continued to play with the Patriots until your contract ran out, and then you moved on to the L.A. Raiders in November of 1983. But there was a lot more that went on into you switching teams, including, I think, the Patriots receiving draft picks. Take us back to the details of that settlement and how tough that was to sit out for most of the season.
Well, I sat out for most of the season because there was no free agency. Today, a player, at the end of his contract, other teams can bid for his services and he can go to the highest bidder. Back in those days, the team you were drafted to, they owned your rights, and the only way you were going to get a fair contract is if they wanted to give you a fair contract. And in my case, in New England, you know, the Sullivans would say they didn't have it. They just don't have the money. And I said, well, then please try to trade me. I want to, you know, a long life isn't guaranteed. A long career is not guaranteed. So I need to try and make the money while I can. And they tried to trade me, and they started talking to the Raiders, and the trading deadline elapsed, and they didn't have a deal. Pat Sullivan called me and said that he was sorry that they weren't able to work out a deal with the Raiders, and I thought my NFL career was over. And because there was no way that I was going to play for, you know, the amount of money that they were talking about giving me or paying me, much like the punt return situation. Yeah, I just ended up giving it up because I'm not going to do it for free. I'm that crazy. And so when I hung up with him, I told my wife, hey, it looks like I won't be playing football this year. And then the phone rang about 5 minutes later, and it was Al Davis. And he said, Mike, well, I was able to work out a deal with the Patriots. And I go, what? Are you kidding me? I just got off the phone with Pat Sullivan. He said, you guys didn't work out a deal. And that upset him quite a bit. He hung up the phone, and I got on the phone and called my attorney. He asked me to come out to Los Angeles where his office was and actually where the Raiders were as well. And so I stayed with him. And we negotiated a contract with the Raiders, which was a violation of the collective bargaining agreement. You were supposed to work out a deal with the team that you were drafted to or who had your contract, your last contract. And if there was a trade done, then they would trade your contract to the other team. Well, that didn't happen in my case. And signed a contract, and the NFL came in and said that contract was no good. So I had to sue the NFL to try and get this all figured out. And so in the court, the judge wanted to hear the case. You know, on one side, we were talking about, you know, violation potentially of antitrust laws. And the league side was saying that this case did not belong in the court, that it was a place that the NFL, a situation the NFL could resolve through their arbitration system, but the judge didn't agree with them and wanted to hear the case. And we, of course, when we walked out the door of the courtroom, the NFL attorneys basically said that I could go to the Raiders. We'd work out the draft choices later because they did not want the Patriots have to open up their books to prove that they could not afford to pay me, and which would have set a precedent for all the teams. And at that point in time, that's just not something that the league wanted to do. So technically, I guess I'm the first free agent, you know, and there was the first case anyway. About four years later, there was another case involving Raymond McNeil and Marcus Allen and a few other guys. and we had already had a precedent, and that helped free agency, become a reality for the players in that day.
We'll get back to the show in a moment, but first I want to talk to you about Audible. Audible.com is the premier provider of digital audiobooks. Audible has over 180,000 titles to choose from in every genre. Thrillers, business, romance, comedy, sci-fi, and more. Audible titles play on iPhone, Kindle, Android, or MP3 players for listening anytime, anywhere. Just for you, my listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. To download your free audiobook right now, go to audibletrial.com/profilesinsports. Again, that's audibletrial.com/profilesinsports, all one word, for your free audiobook today. Well, that move to the Raiders was very fortunate, certainly for yourself and the Raiders themselves. I certainly don't have to ask you what the best moment of your playing career was, because it was later that season in Super Bowl 18. You and Lester Hayes teamed up to shut down a Washington Redskins offense that had set the record for most points scored in a single season to just 9 in a resounding victory for the Raiders, and you also got yourself an interception. Did you think going into that game that the defense could have that much of an effect on that Redskin offense, considering how good it was?
You know, I never really think like that. So all I really could think about is, you know, could I play at a high level for, say, 80 plays, whatever amount of plays we're going to play that day. I looked at their offense, and they're very good, very sound, very talented, big offensive line, big running back, little running back, a great quarterback, great receivers. I knew that we had talented players too on our side of the ball, and just didn't know how it was all going to shape up. And you know, it worked out great. Even though we practiced hard, and you know, you could say all the things we practiced and prepared for the game, I don't really think that we knew what defenses we were going to run going in that game against them. We play a lot of man-to-man, which is normal for us. But you know, we blitzed a lot, and I don't think they were used to the Redskins were not used to man-to-man coverage in the NFL. In the NFC, most of the teams played zone and occasionally played man-to-man, and then when they did play man-to-man, they didn't play bump and run. So the receivers were able to run up the field and read the defense and make their adjustments. But when you're playing bump and run, it's a little bit different situation for them. So I don't think they were prepared for us more than anything.
Picked off by Haynes, intended for Monk. Typical of the kind of game he's had and the frustration of Theismann. Second interception of the day.
I think, like you said, I think that did typify the whole day. Tight coverage, man-to-man coverage. Wherever he goes, I go. To Mike Haynes, he's right there, step for step. Ball goes up, he goes up, gets the interception. I don't know that I've ever seen such coverage on wide receivers as we've seen today.
I would agree with you.
You completed your NFL career in 1989 and, as said earlier, was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1997. But certainly the biggest challenge of your life came when you were diagnosed with prostate cancer back in 2008. If you could, take us back to how you found out that you did have prostate cancer.
Well, I was, at the time, I was working in the NFL office, and my boss had asked me to go to a screening that this was the very first screening of a new campaign that was being launched between the NFL and the Urology Care Foundation, which is now just called Urology Cares. I take it back. I said that wrong. They were the American Urological Foundation, and now it's Urology Cares Foundation. Sorry about that.
Okay.
But anyway, at the screening, these ladies asked me to go ahead and take part, and I said, well, I just took a physical. I don't really need to do this again. She said, well, it's just a simple blood test. It might just encourage some of the other guys to do it. So I did, and the doctor called me in to tell me the results of my test, and he was asking a lot of questions, and I didn't have any answers for him. He asked me what my baseline PSA was. I had no idea what PSA was, and I thought it was a public service announcement. That's not what he was talking about. And so he asked me if prostate cancer ran in my family. I didn't know. I knew that my grandfather died of some kind of cancer, but I didn't know what it was. And so when he gave me the statistics of how many men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer in their lifetime, I was shocked. So if it runs in your family, 1 in 3. If you're African-American, 1 in 5. And it was 1 in 6 for all men at the time would be diagnosed with this disease in their lifetime. I thought, that's a lot of men. Why don't I know more about it? And the doctor didn't know. So when I got back home, called my primary care doctor, gave him those results. He looked at my chart. And he said, well, since you are African-American, we ought to get you a biopsy, Mike. And so I said, okay. You know, I didn't hesitate. He's my doc. I know he's got my interest in at heart. And so I went to a urologist and talked to him. And he said, based on what our conversation with my PSA and the results of my last physical, that I should have been in there earlier. For a biopsy. And so anyway, I took the biopsy, which is not a lot of fun. And any man out there that's had it can attest to that. It's not a lot of fun, but it's a necessary test if you want to know if you have the disease. And my test came back positive. I had cancer in 9 of the 12 places that they checked. And it was shocking because I basically, you know, didn't have any symptoms. I was in good health. Everything was going great. Nothing seemed to be wrong. And the only thing that could have, that maybe I could have done better was to know my personal history, to know that it ran in my family, to know that I was likely to get it, a 1 in 3 chance I'm going to get it. And I could have been looking out for it. And the way I found out I had it was by luck, really, by being in the right place, the right time, and having a conversation with the doctor and following up on what he said with talking to my own urologist.
And since then, you have partnered with the Urology Cares Foundation to help raise awareness for this illness, as I mentioned at the top. When did this partnership begin, and tell us about your role with the organization?
Well, after I had my surgery, I had a radical prostatectomy, which means I had my prostate removed, and I got a positive result from my doctor that we got all the cancer, and I was really feeling good about things. Head of the Urology Care Foundation asked if I would become the spokesperson, and I said yes for a lot of reasons, but mainly to try and use my Hall of Fame status to help their efforts to educate the public about the importance of early detection and the importance of knowing your own personal risk of getting the disease. And so that goes back now to 2008. It's been a great relationship. I think we've done an awful lot of cool things in terms of getting awareness out there, and we continue to do those things. As a spokesperson, I've talked to hundreds of men that are prostate cancer survivors or being recently diagnosed with the disease, and it's allowed me to make a difference in their lives and hopefully the lives of a lot of future persons who may be diagnosed with this disease. I've been up on the Hill in Washington, D.C., talking to congressmen and been on national television shows and with so many other great athletes, not all of them survivors, guys like Mark Zallin and Chris Carter, Michael Irvin, Harry Carson, you know, I can go on and on and on. So many guys who really have helped us get the word out, including Commissioner Goodell, did a public service announcement that they actually played at one of the Super Bowls. I think it was the one in New York. Mm-hmm. So it's a passion of mine, and it's a passion of theirs, and so it's really like a great marriage.
Well, it's stating the obvious to say we're so thankful that you've survived and you're become an advocate, and so that you're able to watch your son, Tate, really take after you as a standout defensive back and a quarterback at Cathedral Catholic in San Diego. And I heard he recently committed to play defensive back at Boston College in a city you're quite familiar with beginning next season.
Well, he has, and one of the coaches visited with us last night, came out on his recruiting trip, and we talked about Tate playing quarterback. That's a position he's played most of his life, and you know, their interest was in him as a defensive back because of his speed and his ability to change directions real quickly and how he can flip his hips around and turn and go on a dime. He's really an incredible athlete, but his real passion is quarterback, and I think that he deserves a chance to play quarterback, and I think that if he didn't get that chance, he might you know, hate it later. And so I think last night in talking with the coach who was here, wasn't Coach Adazio, the head coach, he was one of the assistant coaches, and he said that he believes that Coach Adazio will let him have that opportunity, and if he does let him have that opportunity, he's going to take it, and hopefully he'll do well. Because I know that's where his passion is. But if he doesn't, he loves sports. He loves athletics. And I'm sure he'll make the transition to be a defensive back if that's what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be great to follow his progress. And one last question for you, Mike. And we'll circle back to today's NFL, and specifically with defensive backs. As we mentioned earlier, the 1978 rule changes strongly benefited offenses. And over time, we've seen increased passing yards, increase in receiving yards. Do you think there has been no tougher time to play cornerback than today?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I really don't. I mean, the good corners out there, the Richard Shermans, the Darrell Revises, the Patrick Petersons, and Normans, and, you know, guys, and you probably know their names better than me because you really follow the game probably a lot more than I do. But it's doable. I don't think that you're going to be able to shut a guy out every game for 16 games, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to have too many of those situations happen over a career. I think that there are different things that guys can do to excel at that position and still have a great career and a huge impact on the game. Richard Sherman, I was just watching him the other night, and he's still doing it. You know, he's doing great. He's using his skills, and what I think a lot of people don't give these guys credit for, you know, I give them enough credit for, is you have to be pretty smart. You know, you study film, you look for idiosyncrasies of the receiver, the quarterback, the line. You use the statistics that they give you to help you prepare for the game in a way that's going to give you an edge and give you hopefully an opportunity to feel like you're in control and you're not just responding to every single little thing that you see in front of you. That you, there are different times when you can take a chance or a gamble, or you can set up the offensive player or the quarterback and get them off their game and fake them out where they thought you were in cover two and you were in cover, you know, four or something. So it's a challenge, and I think it's one of the greatest positions out there that I think everybody knows how difficult it is. But I don't really think those guys really get enough credit for how smart they are. And that's the only way you're going to be a great cornerback or a great defensive back year in and year out, game after game.
Well, it's a great challenge, and you were one of the best at addressing that challenge and being one of the best cornerbacks in NFL history. Mike Haynes, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks so much for your time, and all the best to you.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it.
Be sure to download and listen to all episodes of Profiles in Sports on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and most other places you listen to podcasts. You can also follow the show via profilesinsports.com or our Facebook page. And you can follow yours truly, Brian Wright, on Twitter, at BrianWright86.